It's a joy to greet you in the name of the Lord. Welcome back to Veritas class, where we seek the truth. Isn't that what Veritas is all about? We are still in Mordor. Some of you are wondering, will we ever get out of Mordor? And you are asking, why do we spend all this time on this text? Ellen keeps asking me that. Can't we just move on? And the answer is yes, we can. But one of the reasons why the concept is so troubling in our time is because we never spend time here. We read the Bible so superficially, we're looking for sound bites, and to us, the violence of God in the Old Testament is a sound bite. And if we don't wrestle with the texts that deal with it in detail, we'll never get it. And so, the amount of space biblical authors give to certain topics should be respected because it reminds us how significant that topic is to the biblical author. And we want to think God's thoughts after him. So we've been in Mordor since the beginning of October. We will get out. If we would go really quickly today, we'd get out today, but that's too optimistic. I will try to have a new heading next week. Out of the depths of Mordor. Just on time for lunch. In any case, as a person who has spent his life in the First Testament, there is no issue I get more questions about than this one. Which is one of the reasons why a colleague of mine, actually the guy who's taking over for me at Wheaton, Danny Carroll, edited a book on wrestling with the violence of God. It's a collection of essays in here. If you want more discussion of what we're doing here, quite technically, actually, I have an essay in here. How can we bless the Lord? Wrestling with divine violence in Deuteronomy. So, some of you have asked for more information on some of this, and I need to scan that document, and a couple of you have asked for it, and I'll send it to you if I remember. But my forgetter works better every day. It's trumping my rememberer, but in any case, there's where we are. I sent you the notes. Again, those of you who are new to the class, if you want to get the notes in advance of the class, this is the place to get that on your computer. Send Don Motes your name at this address, and he will get the notes to you every Friday or Saturday, depending on when I get them ready. I think you will have got them yesterday in the morning. They should have come. So, in the interests of trees, we're not running off copies for everybody here, but we can send you them every in preparation. So, and the other thing to notice here, some of you are new to the class and you want to know how we got to Mordor. You can go here and you can get audio recordings of everything we've done here for the last millennium. Well, whoops. Actually, I'm in the wrong place. That's the problem here. I should be here. It is the 30th, isn't it? It is Reformation Sunday. We rejoice today in the rediscovery of the gospel with Martin Luther. If we didn't know how dark darkness is, there would be no gospel. There is no grace. And our appreciation for the grace of God will be directly proportional to our sense of deserving the other. And this gives us a picture of the darkness. All right, we're in the verses, we started verses 47 to 57, the second volley of curses upon the people, verses 47 to 48, the underlying causes of Israel's demise, their rebellion, then the character and tactics of the invader whom God sends in. Now in verses 53 to 57, we encounter the horrific consequences of the Lord's action against Israel. And if you were still not where, yes, here's where we want to be. If you have your pages with you, I sent you the synopsis. Do you know what a synopsis is? You can opt two things at the same time. Look at two things at the same time. What I've done here is taken verses 56 and 57, well, actually 54 through 57, and put them side by side, and you can see how Moses, as he is proclaiming this, anticipating this horrific context, he deals first of all with how men respond, and then with how women respond to the distress that's coming. The theme, of course, is at the top. And you will eat of the fruit of your own womb, the flesh of your sons and daughters, whom the Lord your God has given you in the siege and in the distress with which your enemies will distress you. As for the man who is tender among you, I love the word tender here, rak. This is the word that's used of Josiah, because your heart was tender. So he's talking here about the most tender of men. This is not a female characteristic. This is a human characteristic. And all of us should be tender. But as for the man who is tender among you and very refined, he will be mean to his brother, to the wife of his bosom, and to the remainder of his children, the children who remain, so that he will not give to any of them any of the flesh of his children whom he is eating, because he has nothing else left in the siege and in the distress with which your enemy will distress you in all your gates. Then the other side of this coin, as for the woman who is tender among you and refined, who wouldn't venture to set the sole of her foot on the ground because she's so delicate and tender? I mean, this is obviously not a lawyer talking or a legislator. This is a preacher talking and imagining, and he's creating a picture in as impressive a rhetorical way as he can. This is rhetoric. You can just imagine. She will be mean to the husband of her bosom and to her son and to her daughter and to her afterbirth that comes out from between her feet and to the children she bears, because lacking everything, she will eat them secretly in the siege and in the distress with which your enemy will distress you in your gates. Can you imagine? This is in the Bible. But my folks, this is life. This is real. The Bible is very realistic. And of course, the context is at the beginning. They will lay siege to all the cities throughout your land. You need to imagine now how warfare works. Warfare is not pleasant in any context. But in order to preserve a community, what they would do is they would build walls around the city. This is a map of ancient Beersheba. Some of us were there just a few months ago. It's a map of ancient Beersheba where you see the walls all around. And here is the entry gate and here's an assembly point. But there are all sorts of storage areas in here where they reserved or stored grain that should last for years. The tactic used by an invader in conquering these would be to lay a siege around the city so that no food could come in to feed the people. You'd literally try to starve them out. And this is why the well at Beersheba is technically outside the city wall. But what they did is they dug down, way down to the water table level within the walls so that even when the city was being besieged by outsiders, there was water. Great care was taken to do this. This is simply a more clear mock-up if the lights weren't on. Well, the point is, we have extreme stress. They will be hard-pressed because the enemy has surrounded the gate. The enemy whom God has sent in, incidentally. The effect. Well, what happens when we do this? We have a picture of Jerusalem's siege anticipated by Ezekiel in chapter 4, Ezekiel, some of us call him the nut of the Old Testament, except everything is deadly serious. He's not a clown. This is not street theater. This is deadly serious. Chapter 4, you have a whole series of sign actions, symbolic actions, by which Ezekiel is proclaiming the message of the coming doom. Here's what he says. See, I am putting cords on you so that you cannot turn from one side to the other until you've completed the days of your siege. The Lord is binding up Ezekiel. I have no idea how that works. God is talking. I am putting cords on you. And you take wheat and barley, beans and lentils, millet and spelt, put them into one vessel and make bread for yourself during the number of the days that you lie on your side, 390 days, you will eat it. You've seen that before. You've seen this. Ezekiel bread. Where do you find this? Whole Foods? Health food stores? Amazing. And if you read the inscriptions, Ezekiel 4:9, sprouted grain loaf is inspired by the Holy Scripture verse. Take also unto thee wheat, barley, beans, lentils, millet, spelt, and put them. We discovered that when these six grains and legumes are sprouted and combined, an amazing thing happens. They become a nutritious food source. Ezekiel 4:9, loaf is made from freshly sprouted, organically grown grains, is naturally flavorful and bursting with nutrients, with no added fat. Try it served warm to release its exceptionally rich, nutty flavor. Where's the nut? Oh, they got cereal. Easy. Sprouted whole grain cereal. This is supposed to be health food. magnificent food. And you can go online here at the bottom. I've got the, go online, Google Ezekiel bread, and you can get the recipe. Homemade Ezekiel bread, 2.5 cups wheat grain, either red or hard wheat, 1.5 cups spelt, whole barley. Really? What's wrong with that? This is not health food. What is Ezekiel doing? He is scraping the bottom of every barrel, hopeful that perhaps if we get that few grains from every barrel, we might have enough for one loaf of bread. This has nothing to do with health food, absolutely zero, nothing. This is desperation food. We're starving. That's the context. Read the whole chapter, chapter 4 and chapter 5, and you learn how desperate things get when the siege is set. And of course, in our health and wealth gospel, we want everything to... We completely miss the point. This is not health. This is not comfort food. This is discomfort food. You don't know how it works. Let's talk. There are a few verses in the Old Testament that speak of this. Ezekiel 5. Chapter 4, Ezekiel has the series of sign acts, and then in chapter 5, he interprets them. Therefore, in your midst, fathers will eat their children, and children will eat their fathers. I will inflict punishment on you and scatter all your... Really? That's because you can't even find crumbs or kernels, floor sweepings, anywhere. Nothing's left, so what do? The impulse of self-preservation is extremely strong, so the strong eat the weak. Jeremiah 19, I will make them eat the flesh of their sons and daughters, and they will eat one another's flesh during the stress of the siege imposed on them by the enemies who seek their lives. Lamentations. With their own hands, compassionate women have cooked their own food, their own children who became their food. When these are not, they're not just making this up. You can't make this stuff up. It happens. Really? Here's a story. 2 Kings 6. The Syrian siege of Samaria, northern kingdom. As the king of Israel was passing by on the wall, a woman cried out to him, "Help me, my lord, the king!" And the king replied, "If the Lord doesn't help you, where can I get help from you? From the threshing floor? From the wine press? You need food." And he asked her, "What's the matter?" She answered, "This woman said to me, 'Give up your son so we may eat him today, and tomorrow we'll eat my son.' So we cooked my son and ate him. And the next day I said to her, 'Give up your son,' but she's hidden him." That's life and death. In the ancient world. Here, we have already read this earlier. May Adad, the canal inspector of heaven and earth, put an end to Mati'ilu's land and the people of his land through hunger, want, and famine. May they eat the flesh of their sons and daughters, and may it taste as good to them as the flesh of spring lambs. Oh, we have it so good in our land. It's hard for us even to imagine this. But it's what people do when they're desperate, as are Haddon. May a mother bar the door to her daughter. In your hunger, eat the flesh of your sons. In want and famine, may one man eat the flesh of another. May one man clothe himself in another's skin. Just as this ewe has been cut open and the flesh of her young has been placed in her mouth, may they May they make you eat in your hunger the flesh of your brothers, your sons, and your daughters. We've sanitized life. This is the reality. So, it's not making this up. This happens. Well, a few comments on these two panels back to this. Actually, there, I think I had a text earlier here, way back here. The background, yes, we didn't read this. Leviticus 26. Leviticus 26 has the blessings and the curses as God spoke them on Mount Sinai, revealed them to Moses. In Deuteronomy, we've got Moses preaching on the business. So back here, this is what's in Moses' mind as he gives us chapter 28. If in spite of this you still do not listen to me but continue to be hostile toward me, then in my anger I will be hostile toward you, and I myself will punish you for your sin 7 times 7 over. You will eat the flesh of your sons and flesh of your daughters. Doesn't that make God an accomplice in the crime? On the surface, it looks like it. But that's why we have to read the whole Bible and the whole story through and in detail, not just superficially. Let's go back to this. Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Somewhere in the day of reading way back in my youth, somewhere I'm thinking that this was a statement about this not being a civilized society, and that thus and so these countries are more civilized, or we had come to be more civilized. Did I make that up, or is this, I don't know where it came from or when it was discussed in history class or anything, but it just suddenly came to me as you were reading this, that they were claiming that to be more civilized. And I don't know if it comes from this in Scripture.
Well, there are lots of people who claim that the God of the New Testament is more civilized than the God of the Old. And so we're thankful we worship the God of the New Testament. But then you have to ask yourself, Marcion, the ancient heretic, there are two different gods at play here. The Creator God and the Savior. These are two different gods. And so he didn't even try to reconcile them. On the other hand, those of us who claim that this is, there's one God, only one God, yesterday, the same, today, and forever, the same yesterday, today, and forever, in actual fact, we don't believe that, because something happened between the two testaments. God became enlightened. God changed. So you get to the New Testament, you've got a God of love, and here we've got a God of vengeance. Duh. Really? You can't have it that way. And if you think we're more civilized than this, we've got evidences of this kind of violence going on around us. And we have evidences of similar kind of heartlessness. The most tender man and woman among you sacrificing their children in self-interest. Completely self-interest. We are not that much more civilized. We got a problem. It's a moral problem. We only express the same self-centeredness in different ways. And we are violent in different ways. Anyway, back to these two. Commentary on the two panels. Notes. Both begin by highlighting the cultural refinement of the people who are reduced to eating. People you would never expect this of. I mean, they're the elite. They're the refined. They drink out of China. It's a shocker. But that's how desperate you get. Both panels depict men and women respectively turn against members of their own family, and they won't even share their food with their other members of the family. In both panels, the hostility extends to the children, obviously, though he refers to them differently. Both highlight the self-interest of the consumers and the secretive nature. By consumers, I don't mean people who go to the store and shop. I mean people who eat. That's the consumers. Both highlight the self-interest and the secretive. You wouldn't dare do this in public because you know it's so horrible and so wrong. So you secretly, and all of a sudden, your neighbors start wondering, whatever happened to that little boy or that little girl? No idea. Both end by highlighting the extreme stress. Here's a picture. Here is an actual, this is taken from Josephus when, I have to find it here, when Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 AD. Josephus writes, I think it's worth my time reading, in his War 6201, that's the reference, 201 to 203. He reports the speech of a woman who had resorted to eating her own child during the siege of Jerusalem in AD 70. Among the residents of the region beyond Jordan was a woman named Mary, a daughter of Eleazar, of the village of Bethzuba. The name means house of the hyssop, eminent by reason of her family and fortune, who had fled with the rest of the people to Jerusalem and there become involved in the siege. So she's obviously one of these tender hoity-toities. The bulk of her property, which she had packed up and brought with her from Perea to the city, had been plundered by the tyrants, while the relics of her treasures and whatever food she had contrived to procure were being carried off by their satellites in their daily raids. With deep indignation in her heart, the poor woman constantly abused and cursed these extortioners and so incensed them against her. But when no one, either out of exasperation or pity, put her to death, weary of finding for others food, which indeed it was now impossible from any quarter to procure, while famine coursed through her intestines and marrow, and the fire of rage was more consuming even than the famine, impelled by the promptings alike of fury and necessity, she proceeded to an act of courage, outrage upon nature. Different word. Seizing her child, an infant at the breast, poor babe, she cried, amidst war, famine, and sedition, to what end should I preserve thee? With the Roman slavery awaits us, should we live till it come? But famine is forestalling slavery, and more cruel than both are the rebels. Come, be thou food for me, to the rebels an avenging fury, and to the world a tale such as alone is wanting to the calamities of the Jews. With these words, she slew her son, and then having roasted the body and devoured half of it, she covered up and stored the remainder. At once the rebels were upon her, and scenting the unholy odor, threatened her with an instant death unless she produced what she had prepared. Replying that she had reserved a goodly portion for them also, she disclosed the remnants of her child. Seized with instant horror and stupefaction, they stood paralyzed by the sight. She, however, said, "This was my only child. This is my handiwork. Eat, for I too have eaten. Show not yourselves weaker than a woman or more compassionate than a mother. But if you have pious scruples and shrink from my sacrifice, then let what I have eaten be your portion, and the remainder also be left for me." At that they departed trembling, and in this one instance, cowards, though scarcely yielding even this food to the mother. The whole city instantly rang with the abomination, and each, picturing the horror of it, shuddered as though it had been prepared by himself. The starving folk longed for death and felicitated those who had gone to their rest ere they had heard or beheld such evils. This is real. This is real. The depths of Mordor. This is as low as it gets. Well, that's the second folly. There's more. The third folly, 58 to 68. like the others. This is very, very consciously organized. Moses is such a logical, unlike my presentations, which are often here and there and everywhere. What Moses does typically is actually quite ordered. In this one, 58 to 68, guess what? That gets us to the end. Thankfully. You have an opening warning against covenant infidelity, then the consequences of covenant infidelity. Three strikes and you're out. Speaking of baseball. Strike one, plague and disease. Strike two, dispersion. Strike three, enslavement. And that's it. The story's over. Or is it? Well, here we go. The opening warning against covenant infidelity. This is verse 58. If you're not careful to observe all the words of this Torah that are written in this book, to fear this honored and awesome name, the Lord your God. That's how my translation has. It's probably something like what your translation has as well, if you are not careful. But actually, it doesn't go that way. The text is a little different. All our translations do that. They miss something. Really, it says, if you do not keep by doing all the words of this Torah, which are written in this book. Actually, it's not a book. They didn't have books. We've talked about that before. In this document, scroll here, by fearing this honored and awesome name. Something's missing. If you do not keep by doing and by fearing, keep what? This is the only place where this construction has no object. He's dropped something. And so the translations assume that keep and do, or keep to do, they think that's simply an emphatic, carefully keep. Not quite. The opening, but it's important when we see this opening conditional clause. If you do not keep, do you see the grace? If you do not keep. Israel's future is up to them. This fate is not inevitable. If you keep. And of course, we saw that in verses 1 to 14, how God begins, Moses begins with this profuse declaration of blessing, blessing. This is God's dream, set Israel high above the nations for praise and honor and glory. And then the nations will see you are branded by the name of the Lord. They will see what grace can do. There's the will. There's God's plan. There's his desire. But again, if you do not keep what? If you do not keep by doing and fearing. Elsewhere, it always has an object. It's either keep the commands, keep the ordinance, keep the judgments, or what's another possibility? Keep what? The covenant. The covenant. That's it. Genesis 17, 9 to 10. And God said to Abraham, this goes all the way back there. As for you, you will keep my covenant. Or you shall keep my covenant. You and your offspring after you throughout the generations. This is my covenant that you shall keep between me and your offspring. And so he already gave. This is a common idiom. Keep the covenant. As opposed to breaking the covenant. We'll come back to that one. It shows up again. Exodus 19:5. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice. Again, I just cut and pasted. What should it be? listen to my voice. God speaks grace as much as he speaks command. So don't. If you will indeed listen to my voice and keep my covenant, you will be my treasured possession among all the peoples of the earth. For all the earth is mine. This is the dream. This is the vision. This is the mission for which Israel has been ordained. The privilege, the mission. If you do not. So what our text, I think, is, if you do not keep the covenant, I think that's the gap we fill in, by doing and by fearing, doing all the words of this Torah. How does one keep the command? Not by hanging them on the Ten Commandments on the wall. I mean, if you go to the Amish woodworker craftsman's shops in northern Indiana, they do beautiful, magnificent stuff like this. I was going to bring that one home and put it on the wall. It's big. I have a wall where it could go. That's not why I didn't do it. I have two reasons for not doing it. One, look where it starts. You shall have no other gods besides me. It starts with command. The document doesn't start with command. It starts with gospel. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. That's one thing. The other thing is, the Decalogue was never written for public display in the parks or in the courthouses, whatever. Where was it kept? In the Ark of the Covenant. Who saw it? No, nobody. We don't know that ark lid was ever opened. Well, yes, actually, because they put something else in there too, didn't they? A little jug of manna. So somebody opened it at that point. But other than that, the proof of fidelity to covenant is not putting up labels, bumper stickers. Honk if you love Jesus. What's the proof? The transformed life. Pardon me? If you love me, keep my commands. That's it. So, you look at how does one keep the covenant? By doing all the words of this document, not by signing creedal statements. It's by living creedally, orthopraxy. By demonstrating trusting awe, by fearing the Lord your God, the glorified and awesome name that is the Lord your God. Now you have to remember what this word fear means in Deuteronomy. And actually, it is a very elastic word that means a wide range of things depending on the context. And if you go look in Deuteronomy alone, where it appears dozens of times, in some places it means utter terror. At Sinai, stop, we're dead. Stop, God talk. They feared for their lives. But elsewhere it means fright, not necessarily deadly, but fright, anxiety, awe, reverence. You can be awed, but still be negative related to the person before whom you're awed. Reverence, now you're moving to the positive. Submission, allegiance, trust. That allegiance one. When Jonah, we're far afield, except we need to understand what fear means. When Jonah's on that boat and they have this press conference, the sailors ask him, "Who are you? Where do you come from? And what are you doing?" Good questions, Jonah. What does he say? "I am a Hebrew. I fear Yahweh, maker of heaven and earth." That's when the guys get really frightened. Because they thought they were fighting only the sea god, the sea monster. That's one enemy. So they were offering their gifts to that monster. Now they discover it's not just the sea monster we're fighting. It is the God of heaven. That's when they're really scared. Is Jonah afraid of God? No, he's not. In that case, fear does not mean fright. It means I am a member of the people of God. My allegiance is to Him. He defines my identity. But then, of course, it also means trust. Trusting awe. Abraham sacrificed his son Isaac. Now the Lord tested Abraham, saying, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac. What does Abraham do? What's being tested? His trust of God. The text starts with, now it happened after these things. What things? What happened in chapter 21? The Lord had just told Abraham, not in Ishmael, but in Isaac. The very next chapter, after these things, take your son, your only son, whom you love, and go and offer him as a whole burnt offering. Lots of questions there. What does Abraham do? He gets up early in the morning, saddles his donkey, and packs the stuff, and with Isaac he's off, and they walk for 3 days. Did he tell Sarah what he was doing? I hope not. I mean, it's one thing to obey impulsively, instantly, but he had 3 days to think about it, to change his mind. They get to the mountain. He says to his servant, stay here. We're going up to the mountain to worship God. That's the first occurrence of the word worship in the Bible. And it is not what we think of to do church. Worship is an act of prostration and humiliation and submission before God. And he's about to slay his son, and the angel grabs his arm. Stop, stop. Now I know that you trust me. No, it doesn't use the word trust. It uses the word fear. He passed the test. A++. And it's all about trust. Trusting awe. If you do not keep the covenant by doing and demonstrating trusting awe. What does this look like in Deuteronomy? By worshiping the Lord rightly in the place he has chosen, stamped with his name. Priests ministering well before the Lord and blessing well in his name. By prophets proclaiming the Lord's word as he directs them. By the people proclaiming his name in liturgical celebration, serving him without reservation, swearing only by his name, representing the Lord well, bearing his name wherever they go. Chapter 10. What now does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to love him and to serve him? And then the little finger, oh, and by the way, keep the commands. But it's all about attitudes and dispositions first. That's what it looks like. Well, that's the condition. If you do not keep the covenant, which is a gift. Your role is a gift. It's a privilege. If you don't, the high calling, if you don't, here are the consequences. Notice, first of all, verses 59 to 68. This builds on chapter 4, 26. This is not new. It's what I call resumptive exposition. He had given us an idea earlier. Now he picks up on that idea and he unpacks it. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today. You will surely soon utterly perish from the land that you're crossing the Jordan to occupy. verse 25 actually says, if in the future you go after other gods and you abandon me, you will utterly perish. Land, it'll be utterly destroyed. The Lord will scatter you among the peoples. Only a few of you will be left among the nations where the Lord will lead you. There you will serve other gods made by human hands, objects of wood and stone that neither see nor eat. Three strikes and you're out. In each of these, you've got the Lord's reaction to infidelity and then the effect of the action. Here are the three actions. If you refuse to keep the covenant, the first strike is on the left. Then the Lord your God will bring on you and your descendants extraordinary plagues, harsh and prolonged disasters, and grievous and lasting sickness. He'll bring on you again all the diseases of Egypt of which you were afraid, and they will cling to you. Every sickness also and every affliction that is not recorded in the book of the Torah, Yahweh will bring upon you until you... We've heard all this before, haven't we? Why? The repetition. The second strike. And you will be plucked off the land that you're entering to take possession of it. And the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end. So the first is all kinds of plagues. The second one is destroying this covenant triangle, removing the people from the land, exile. And then the last strike, and the Lord will bring you back in ships to Egypt, a journey that I promised that you should never make again. Three strikes. And what are the effects? In the first case, after the plagues are done, you will be left few in number instead of being as numerous as the stars of heaven because you didn't obey the voice of the Lord. Again, listen to the voice. And as the Lord took delight in doing you good and multiplying you, so the Lord will take delight in bringing ruin upon you and destroying you. That's the consequence of the plagues the Lord sends. The consequence of the exile, the middle column, you'll be plucked off and sent to... There you will serve other gods of wood and stone, which neither you nor your fathers have known. But there you'll find no relief. And then the last one, there in Egypt, you will offer yourselves for sale to your enemies as male and female, but nobody will buy you. The ultimate insult. Well, let's look at these briefly. Three strikes and you're out. Strike number one. The Lord will bring on you and your descendants extraordinary plagues, harsh and prolonged disasters, grievous and lasting sickness, and he'll bring on you again all the diseases of Egypt of which you were afraid, and they will cling to you. Like every sickness also, every affliction that's not recorded in the book of the Torah. That's interesting. God is not limited to what he has explicitly said. He reserves the right to marshal all kinds of other agents until you are destroyed. Notice the intensity. Moses uses the rare verb hifla to perform an extraordinary act. This was used of the signs and wonders in Egypt. Now it will be used of the disasters. Each object is modified by two expressions emphasizing the severity. The strokes are characterized as great and persistent. The diseases are severe and persistent. You can't lose them. Three, he threatens to bring back Israel, bring back against Israel every dreaded disease in Egypt. In echoing 7:15, this statement explicitly reverses his earlier acts of deliverance from the diseases of Egypt. I think I have 7:15. This is way back there, chapter 7. The Lord will turn away from you every illness. All the dread disease of Egypt that you experience, he will not inflict on you. You're special. You're chosen. You're set apart. The plagues of Egypt are not yours. But now what happens? You get it. You act like an Egyptian, God will treat you like an Egyptian. Four, to reinforce the connotations of persistent, he adds, they will cling to you. Suckers. Five, Moses broadens the scope of the plague beyond those he has mentioned in the present speech and will record in the written version of the Torah, as if the plagues that we've read aren't enough. And any other plague not written in this Torah, watch out. It's interesting. I think this is actually an echo of what kings did in their treaties. Esarhaddon, in one of his treaties, he lists all the gods who are witnesses by name. I think there are 60 in the list. It's a fully populated heaven. And then at the end, divinities that if you are unfaithful, they'll come after you. He says, and all the gods of all the lands. I'm not limiting myself to the gods named here. We've got them all. And then by ending the statement with a declaration of divine action and the intended goal, the last notes ringing in the ears of the hearers would be of the certainty and intensity of the calamity. That's the action. Now look at the effects. And this sounds familiar. You will be left few in number instead of being as numerous as the stars of the heaven. Oh. What's the echo? The promise to Abraham is reversed. The book of Exodus starts out with what I call a birthquake. Chapter 1, verses 1 to 7. In 1, 1 to 6, you have the last time sons of Jacob or sons of Israel is used in that book to mean the family. When you get to 7, sons of Israel is the whole mass of people. And he uses 7 expressions for the multiplication that is happening in Egypt under Pharaoh's nose. And that's what gets Pharaoh so excited, worried, because of this earthquake. What's happening here is that which Pharaoh tried to do, stifle the population growth, God will actually do. He reverses the promise. And it gets shocking. And as the Lord took delight in doing you good and multiplying you, so the Lord will take delight in bringing ruin upon you. A couple of observations. Reversal of the promises to the ancestors, the multiplication of ancestors. Reversal of the Lord's disposition toward his people. Schadenfreude. I don't think we should say God is going to have fun doing this. That's not what delight means. In Isaiah 53, you have the expression, it pleased the Lord to bruise him. We have a lot of people these days very offended with a kind of God who is entertained by the wounds of his servant. No, that's not what it means. He's not entertained. In my essay on the violence of God, I allude to a British scholar, a theologian, Williams, who's actually written on this. And very helpfully, he says, when God visits punishment upon the people, it is always with a heavy heart. It's never fun. Here, pleased doesn't mean he's going to have fun doing this. No, it means this is the will of God. Doesn't mean he's having fun doing it. But as blessing used to be the will, so it now. The notion that the Lord should find delight in destruction of his own people is troubling, to say the least. In Assyria, Asher, the divine patron, may have been the most ferocious and savage divinity, but you would never blame Asher. He would send his demons out so that Asher is not the one who did it. The Bible doesn't go that way. We don't have a fully developed demonology in the Old Testament. Such doctrines may protect patron divinities from having to express their wrath against their own, but the religion of Israel refused to take the easy way out. Apparently, the Lord doesn't pick and choose which attributes of other deities he would like to own. If he claims for himself the positive function associated with fertility, he will also claim the role of the spoiler, even of his own people. You act like a Canaanite, you get treated like a Canaanite. That the Lord, the source of grace and well-being for Israel, should also have such a dark face is recognized by Isaiah. You know this one. I am the one who forms the light and creates darkness. I am the one who produces well-being and creates. There's that word. Many translations have evil, which creates a horrible theological problem. The word evil here. The sons of Israel did the evil in the sight of the Lord. They abandoned the Lord and went after other gods. That's serious evil. Moral evil. But God is never guilty of moral evil. This word is used also of bad experiences. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's actually the tree of knowledge of good and bad. To experience evil. Job went through all sorts of evils. And at the end of the book of Job, for all the evil that the Lord had done to him. Really? No, it's disaster at that point. And so we need to. I am the one who produces.